G is for Gumshoe by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1990 by Sue Grafton. This recording of the full-length reading of G is for Gumshoe was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Incorporated and was produced in 1994 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Mary Pfeiffer. Chapter 1. Three things occurred on or about May 5th, which is not only Cinco de Mayo in California, but happy birthday to me. Aside from the fact that I turned 33, after what seemed like an interminable 12 months of being 32, the following also came to pass. 1. The reconstruction of my apartment was completed, and I moved back in. 2. I was hired by a Mrs. Clyde Gersh to bring her mother back from the Mojave Desert. 3. I made one of the top slots on Tyrone Patty's hit list. I report these events not necessarily in the order of importance, but in the order most easily explained. For the record, my name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator licensed by the state of California. Now, 33 years old, 118 pounds of female in a 5-foot-6-inch frame. My hair is dark, thick, and straight. I'd been accustomed to wearing it short, but I'd been letting it grow out just to see what it would look like. My usual practice is to crop my own mop every 6 weeks or so with a pair of nail scissors. This I do because I'm too cheap to pay $28 in a beauty salon. I have hazel eyes, a nose that's been busted twice but still manages to function pretty well, I think. If I were asked to rate my looks on a scale of 1 to 10, I wouldn't. I have to say, however, that I seldom wear makeup, so whatever I look like first thing in the morning at least remains consistent as the day wears on. I'd been living since New Year's with my landlord, Henry Pitts, an 82-year-old gent whose converted single-car garage apartment I'd been renting for 2 years. This nondescript but otherwise serviceable abode had been blown sky-high, and Henry had suggested that I move into his small back bedroom while my place was being rebuilt. There is, apparently, some law of nature decreeing that all home construction must double in its projected cost and take 4 times longer than originally anticipated. This would explain why, after 5 months of intensive work, the unveiling had finally been scheduled with all the fanfare of a movie premiere. I was uneasy about the new place, because I wasn't at all sure I'd like what Henry had come up with in the way of a floor plan and interior decor. He'd been very secretive and extremely pleased with himself since he'd gotten city approval for the blueprints. I was worried that I'd take one look at the place and not be able to conceal my dismay. I'm a born liar, but I don't do as well disguising what I feel. Still, as I told myself many times, it was his property, and he could do anything he pleased. For $200 a month, was I going to complain? I doesn't think so. I woke at 6 o'clock that Thursday morning, rolled out of bed and into my running clothes. I brushed my teeth, splashed some water on my face, did a perfunctory hamstring stretch, and headed out Henry's back door. May and June in Santa Teresa are often masked by fog. The weather as blank and dreary as the white noise on a TV set when the broadcast day is done. The winter beaches are stripped bare, massive boulders exposed as the tides sweep away the summer sand. We'd had a rainy March and April, but May had come in clear and mild. The sand was being returned as the spring currents shifted, the beaches restored for the tourists, who would begin to pour into the town around Memorial Day and not leave again until Labor Day weekend had come and gone. This dawn was spectacular. Early morning clouds streaking the sky in dark gray tufts, sun tinting the underbelly an intense rose shade. The tide was out, and the beach seemed to stretch toward the horizon in a silvery mirror of reflected sky. Santa Teresa was lush and green, and the air felt soft, saturated with the smell of eucalyptus leaves and the newly cut grass. I jogged 3 miles and was home again 30 minutes later in time for Henry to sing, "Happy birthday to you," as he pulled a pan of freshly baked cinnamon rolls out of the oven. Being serenaded is not my favorite activity, but he did it so badly I could only be amused and gratified. I showered, pulled on jeans, a t-shirt, and my tennis shoes, and then Henry handed me a gift-wrapped jeweler's box that contained the newly minted brass key to my apartment. He was behaving like a kid, his lean, tanned face wreathed in shy smiles, his blue eyes glinting with barely suppressed excitement. In a two-person ceremonial procession, we walked from his back door, across the flagstone patio, to the front door of my place. I knew what the exterior looked like. Two stories of cream-colored stucco with rounded corners in a style I'd have to call Art Deco. Numerous hand-crankable windows had been installed, and there was new landscaping, which Henry had done himself. To tell you the truth, the outward effect was unprepossessing, which I didn't object to a bit. My prime anxiety had always been that he'd make the apartment too fancy for my taste. We took a few minutes to survey the site, Henry explaining in detail all the hassles he'd gone through with the City Planning Commission and the Architectural Board of Review. I knew he was just dragging out the explanation to pump up the suspense, and in truth I was feeling anxious, just wanting to get the whole thing over with. Finally, he allowed me to turn the key in the lock, and the front door, with its porthole-shaped window, swung open. I don't know what I'd expected. I'd tried not to conjure up fantasies of any kind, but what I saw left me inarticulate. The entire apartment had the feel of a ship's interior. The walls were highly polished teak and oak, with shelves and cubby holes on every side. The kitchenette was still located to the right, where the old one had been, a galley-style arrangement with a pint-sized stove and refrigerator. A microwave oven and trash compactor had been added. Tucked in beside the kitchen was a stacking washer-dryer, and next to that was a tiny bathroom. In the living area, a sofa had been built into a window bay, with two royal blue canvas director's chairs arranged to form a conversational grouping. Henry did a quick demonstration of how the sofa could be extended into sleeping accommodations for company, a trundle bed in effect. The dimensions of the main room were still roughly 15 feet on a side, but now there was a sleeping loft above, accessible by way of a tiny spiral staircase where my former storage space had been. In the old place, I'd usually slept naked on the couch in an envelope of folded quilt. Now I was going to have an actual bedroom of my own. I wound my way up, staring in amazement at the double-sized platform bed with drawers underneath. In the ceiling above the bed, there was a round shaft extending through the roof, capped by a clear plexiglass skylight that seemed to fling light down on the blue and white patchwork coverlet. Loft windows looked out to the ocean on one side and the mountains on the other. Along the back wall, there was an expanse of cedar-lined closet space with a rod for hanging clothes, pegs for miscellaneous items, shoe racks, and floor-to-ceiling drawers. Just off the loft, there was a small bathroom. The tub was sunken with a built-in shower and a window right at tub level, the wooden sill lined with plants. I could bathe among the treetops, looking out at the ocean where the clouds were piling up like bubbles. The towels were the same royal blue as the cotton shag carpeting. Even the eggs of milled soap were blue, arranged in a white china dish on the edge of the round brass sink. When the inspection tour was complete, I turned around and stared at him, speechless, a phenomenon that made Henry laugh aloud, tickled with himself that he'd executed his scheme so perfectly. Close to tears, I leaned my forehead against his chest while he patted at me awkwardly. I couldn't ask for a better friend. He left me alone soon afterward, and I went through every cabinet and drawer, drinking in the scent of the wood, listening to the phantom creaking of the wind in the rafters overhead. It took me 15 minutes to move my possessions in. Most of what I owned had been destroyed by the same bomb that flattened the old place. My all-purpose dress had survived, along with a favorite vest and the air fern Henry'd given me for Christmas. Everything else had been pulverized by black powder, blasting caps, and shrapnel. With the insurance money, I'd bought a few odds and ends, jeans and jumpsuits, and then I'd tucked the rest in a money market account where it was merrily collecting interest. At 8:45, I locked up, looked in on Henry briefly, and fumbled my way through yet another thank you, which he waved away. Then I headed to the office, a quick 10-minute drive into town. I wanted to stay home, circling my house like a sea captain preparing to embark on some fabulous voyage, but I knew for a fact I had bills to pay and telephone calls to return. I dispensed with several minor items, typing up a couple of invoices for two standing accounts. The last name on the list of phone calls was a Mrs. Clyde Gersh, who had left a message on my machine late the day before, with a request to get in touch at my convenience. I dialed her number, reaching for a yellow pad. The phone rang twice, and then a woman picked up on the other end. "Mrs. Gersh?"
"Yes,"
she said. Her tone held a note of caution, as if I might be soliciting contributions for some fraudulent charity. "Kinsey Milhone returning your call." There was a split second of silence, and then she seemed to recollect who I was.
"Oh, yes, Miss Milhone. I appreciate your being so prompt. I have a matter I'd like to discuss with you, but I don't drive, and I'd prefer not to leave the house. Is there any chance you might meet with me here sometime today?"
"Sure," I said. She gave me the address, and since I didn't have anything else on the books, I said I'd be there within the hour. There didn't seem to be any particular urgency to the matter, whatever it was. But business is business. The address she'd given me was in the heart of town, not far from my office, one of the older blocks of single-family residences on a quiet, tree-lined street. A tangle of shrubs formed a nearly impenetrable wall that separated the property from street view. I parked out front and let myself in through a creaking gate. The house was a shambling affair, two stories of dark green shingle set sideways on a lot dense with sycamores. I climbed pale gray wooden porch steps, still fragrant with a recent repainting. The screen was open, and I moved to the front door and pushed the bell, surveying the facade. The house was probably built in the 20s, not elegant by any means, but constructed on a large scale, comfortable, unpretentious, once meant for the middle class, out of reach for the average buyer in the current real estate market. A house like this would probably sell for over $500,000 these days, and then require remodeling to bring it up to snuff. An obese black woman in a canary-yellow uniform with white collar and cuffs let me in. "Mrs. Gersh is out on the upstairs porch," she said, indicating a staircase directly ahead. She lumbered off, apparently trusting me not to lift any cut-glass knick-knacks from the occasional table to the right of the entranceway. I had a momentary glimpse of the living room. A wide, painted brick fireplace, flanked by built-in bookcases with leaded glass doors. Lots of cotton shag carpeting in a much trampled off-white. Creamy painted wainscoting ran halfway up the wall with a pale print wallpaper above, extending across the ceiling in an inverted meadow of wildflowers. The room was shadowy and cried out for table lamps. The whole house was muffled in silence, and smelled of cauliflower and curry. I went up. When I reached the first landing, I saw that a second set of stairs branched down into the kitchen, where I could see a kettle bubbling on the stove. The maid who'd admitted me was now standing at the counter, chopping cilantro. Sensing my gaze, she turned and gave me an idle look. I moved on up. At the top of the stairs, a screen door opened onto a broad, flat porch, ringed with wooden planters filled with bright pink and orange geraniums. The main street, two blocks over, ebbed and flowed with traffic noises, as sibilant as the sea. Mrs. Gersh was stretched out on a chaise longue, a plaid lap robe arranged across her legs. She might have been taking the air in a deck chair, waiting for the social director to advise her of the day's shipboard activities. She had her eyes closed, a Judith Krantz novel face down on her lap. The branches of a weeping willow draped long, lacy limbs across one corner of the porch, which was dappled in shade. The day was mild, but the breeze seemed faintly chilly up here. The woman was stick-thin, with the dead-white complexion of someone profoundly ill. She struck me as the sort of woman who, 100 years ago, might have spent long years in a sanitarium with a series of misdiagnoses stemming from anxiety, unhappiness, laudanum addiction, or an aversion to sex. Her hair was an icy blonde, harshly bleached and sparse. bright red lipstick defined the width of her mouth, and she wore matching bright red polish on nails cut short. Her Jean Harlow eyebrows had been plucked to an expression of frail astonishment. Her eyes were defined by false lashes that lay against her lower lids like sutures. I judged her to be in her 50s, but she might have been younger. Disease is an aging process in itself. Her chest was sunken, with breasts as flat as the flaps on an envelope. She wore a white silk blouse, expensive-looking pale gray gabardine slacks, vivid green satin slippers on her feet. "Mrs. Gersh?" She was startled, eyes flying open in a blaze of blue. For a moment she seemed disoriented, and then she collected herself. "You must be Kinsey," she murmured. "I'm Irene Gersh." She held out her left hand and clutched mine briefly, her fingers wiry and cold. "Sorry if I frightened you."
"Don't worry about it. I'm a bundle of nerves. Please, find a chair and sit. I don't sleep well as a rule, and I'm forced to catnap when I can."
A quick survey showed three white mesh lawn chairs stacked together in one corner of the porch. I lifted the top chair, carried it over to the chaise, and sat down.
"I hope Germaine will have the presence of mind to bring us tea, but don't count on it," she said.
She shifted into a more upright position, adjusting the lap robe. She studied me with interest. It was my impression that she approved, though of what I couldn't say.
"You're younger than I thought you'd be."
"Old enough," I said. "Today's my birthday. I'm 33.
"Well, happy birthday. I hope I didn't interrupt a celebration."
"Not at all."
"I'm 47 myself," she smiled briefly. "I know I look like an old hag, but I'm relatively young, given California standards."
"Have you been ill?"
"Let's put it this way. I haven't been well. My husband and I moved to Santa Teresa 3 years ago from Palm Springs. This was his parents' house. When his father died, Clyde undertook his mother's care. She passed away 2 months ago."
I murmured something I hoped was appropriate.
"The point is, we didn't need to move here, but Clyde insisted. Never mind my objections. He was raised in Santa Teresa, and he was determined to come back."
"I take it you weren't enthusiastic." She flashed a look at me.
"I don't like it here. I never did. We used to come for visits, maybe twice a year. I have an aversion to the sea. I always found the town oppressive. There's an aura about it that I find very dark. Everybody's so smitten with the beauty of it. I don't like the attitude of self-congratulation, and I don't like all the green. I was born and raised in the desert, which is what I prefer. My health has deteriorated since the day we arrived, though the doctors can't seem to find anything wrong with me. Clyde is thriving, of course. I suspect he thinks this is a form of pouting on my part, but it's not. It's dread. I wake up every morning filled with debilitating anxiety. Sometimes it feels like a surge of electricity or a weight on my chest, almost overwhelming."
"Are you talking about panic attacks?"
"That's what the doctor keeps calling it," she said.
I murmured noncommittally, wondering where this was all going to lead. She seemed to read my thoughts.
"What do you know about the slabs?" she asked abruptly.
"The slabs?"
"Ah, doesn't ring a bell, I see. Not surprising. The slabs are out in the Mojave, to the east of the Salton Sea. During the Second World War, there was a marine base out there, Camp Dunlap. It's gone now. All that's left are the concrete foundations for the barracks, known now as the slabs. Thousands of people migrate to the slabs every winter from the north. They call them snowbirds because they flee the harsh northern winters. I was raised out there. My mother's still there, as far as I know. Conditions are very primitive. No water, no sewer lines, no city services of any sort, but it costs nothing. The snowbirds live like gypsies, some in expensive RVs, some in cardboard shacks. In the spring, most of them disappear again, heading north. My mother's one of the few permanent residents, but I haven't heard from her for months. She has no phone and no actual address. I'm worried about her. I want someone to drive down there and see if she's all right."
"How often does she usually get in touch?"
"It used to be once a month. She hitches a ride into town and calls from a little cafe in Nyland. Sometimes she calls from Brawley or Westmoreland, depending on the ride she manages to pick up. We talk, she buys supplies, and then hitchhikes back again."
"She has an income? Social Security?"
Mrs. Gersh shook her head. "Just the checks I send. I don't believe she's ever had a social security number. All the years I remember, she supported the two of us with housework, which she did for cash. She's 83 now and retired, of course. How does mail reach her if she has no address?
She has a post office box, or at least she did.
What about the checks? Has she been cashing those?
They haven't showed up in my bank statement, so I guess not. That's what made me suspicious to begin with. She has to have money for food and necessities.
And when did you last hear from her?
Christmas. I sent her some money and she called to thank me.
Things were fine from what she said, though to tell you the truth, she didn't sound good. She does sometimes drink.
What about the neighbors? Any way to get through to them?
She shook her head again.
Nobody has a telephone.
You have no idea how crude conditions are out there. These people have to haul their own trash to the city dump. The only thing provided is a school bus for the children, and sometimes the townspeople raise a fuss about that.
What about the local police? Any chance of getting a line on her through them?
I've been reluctant to try. My mother is very jealous of her privacy, even a bit eccentric when it comes right down to it. She'd be furious if I contacted the authorities.
6 months is a long time to let this ride.
Her cheeks tinted slightly.
I'm aware of that, but I kept thinking I'd hear. Frankly, I haven't wanted to brave her wrath.
I warn you, she's a horror, especially if she's on a tear. She's very independent.
I thought about the situation, scanning the possibilities.
You mentioned that she has no regular address. How do I find her?
She reached down and picked up a leather jewelry case she'd tucked under the chaise. She removed a small envelope and a couple of Polaroid snapshots.
This is her last note, and these are some pictures I took last time I was there.
This is the trailer where she lives. I'm sorry I don't have a snapshot of her.
I glanced at the pictures, which showed a vintage mobile home painted flat blue.
When was this taken?
3 years ago, shortly before Clyde and I moved up here.
I can draw you a map, showing you where the trailer's located. It'll still be there, I guarantee, once someone at the slab squats on a piece of land. Even if it's just a 10-by-10 pad of concrete, they don't move. You can't imagine how possessive people get about raw dirt and a few creosote bushes. Her name, by the way, is Agnes Gray.
You don't have any pictures of her?
Actually, I don't, but everyone knows her. I don't think you'll have a problem identifying her if she's there.
And if I find her, what then?
You'll have to let me know what kind of shape she's in. Then we can decide what course of action seems best. I have to say, I chose you because you're a woman. Mother doesn't like men. She doesn't do well among strangers to begin with, but around men she's worse.
You'll do it, then?
I can leave tomorrow, if you like.
Good. I was hoping you'd say that. I'd like some way to reach you beyond business hours, she said. If Mother should get in touch, I want to be able to call without talking to your machine. An address, too, if you would.
I jotted my home address and phone number on the back of my business card.
I don't give this out often, so please be discreet, I said, as I handed it to her.
Of course. Thank you.
We went through the business arrangements. I'd brought a standard contract, and we filled in the blanks by hand. She paid me an advance of $500 and sketched out a crude diagram of the section of the slabs where her mother's trailer stood. I hadn't had a missing persons case since the previous June, and I was eager to get to work. This felt like a routine matter, and I considered the job a nice birthday present for myself. I left the Gersh house at 12:15, drove straight to the nearest McDonald's, where I treated myself to a celebratory quarter-pounder with cheese.
Chapter 2.
By 1 o'clock I was home again, feeling smug about life. I had a new job, an apartment I was thrilled with. The phone began to ring as I unlocked the door. I snatched up the receiver before my answering machine kicked in.
Ms. Milhone?
The voice was female and unfamiliar. The hiss in the line suggested the call was long distance.
Yes? Will you hold for Mr. Galashoff?
Sure, I said, instantly curious. Lee Galashoff was an attorney in the public defender's office in Carson City, Nevada, whom I'd worked with some 4 years back. At the time, he was trying to track a fellow named Tyrone Patty, believed to be in this area. An armed robbery suspect named Joe Quincy Jackson had been arrested and charged with attempted murder in the shooting of a liquor store clerk. Jackson was claiming that Tyrone Patty was the trigger man. Galashoff was very interested in talking to him. Patty was rumored to have fled to Santa Teresa, and when the local police weren't able to locate him, Galashoff had contacted the investigator for the Santa Teresa Public Defender's Office, who in turn had referred him to me. He filled me in on the situation and then sent me the background information on Patty, along with a mugshot from a previous arrest. I traced the subject for 3 days, doing a paper chase through the city directory, the crisscross, marriage licenses, divorce decrees, death certificates, municipal and superior court records, and finally traffic court. I picked up his scent when I came across a jaywalking ticket he'd been issued the week before. The citation listed a local address, some friend of his as it turned out, and Patty answered my knock. Since I was posing as an Avon sales rep, I was fortunate I didn't have to deal with the lady of the house. Any woman in her right mind would have known at a glance I didn't have a clue about makeup. Patty, operating on other instincts, had shut the door in my face. I reported his whereabouts to Galashoff, who by then had found a witness to corroborate Jackson's claim. A warrant was issued through the Carson City District Attorney's Office. Patty was arrested 2 days later and extradited. The last I'd heard, he'd been convicted and was serving time at the Nevada State Prison in Carson City. Galashoff came on the line.
"Hello, Kinsey. Lee Galashoff. I hope I didn't catch you at a bad time."
His voice was booming, forcing me to hold the receiver 8 inches from my ear. Telephone voices are deceptive. From his manner, I'd always pictured him in his 60s, balding and overweight. But a photograph I'd spotted in a Las Vegas newspaper showed a slim, handsome fellow in his 40s with a shock of blonde hair. "This is fine," I said. "How are you?"
"Good until now. Tyrone Patty's back in county jail, awaiting trial on a triple murder charge."
"What's the story this time?"
"He and a pal of his hit a liquor store up here, and the clerk and two customers were shot to death."
"Really? I hadn't heard that."
"Well, there's no reason you would. The problem is, he's pissed at us. Claims his life was ruined the day he was put away. You know how it goes. Wife divorced him, kids are alienated, the guy gets out and can't find a job. Naturally, he took to armed robbery again, blasting anybody in his way. All our fault, of course."
"Hey, sure, why not?"
"Yeah, well, here's the bottom line. Apparently, a couple weeks ago, he approached another inmate on a contract murder plot involving the two of us, plus the DA and the judge who sentenced him."
I found myself pointing at my chest as I squinted into the receiver.
"Us? As in me?"
My voice had gotten all squeaky, like I was suddenly going through puberty.
"You got it. Fortunately, the other inmate was a police informant who came straight to us. The DA put a couple of undercover cops on it, posing as potential hitmen. I just listened to a tape recording that would chill your blood."
"Are you serious?"
"It gets worse," he said. "From the tape, we can't tell who else he might have talked to. We're concerned he's been in touch with other people who may be taking steps we don't know about. We've notified the press, hoping to make this too hot to handle. Judge Jarvison and I are being placed under around-the-clock armed protection, but they thought I'd better pass the information on to you. You'd be smart to contact the Santa Teresa police to see about protection for yourself."
"God, Lee, I can't imagine they'd provide any, especially on a threat from out of state. They don't have the manpower or the budget for that."
I'd never actually called the man by his first name before, but I felt a certain privilege, given what I'd just heard. If Patty was the plotter, Galashoff and I were fellow plottees.
"We're actually facing the same situation here," he said. "The sheriff's department can't cover us for long, 4 or 5 days at best. We'll just have to see how things stand after that. In the meantime, you might want to hire somebody on your own, temporarily at any rate."
"A bodyguard?" I said.
"Well, somebody versed in security procedures."
I hesitated. "I'd have to think about that," I said. "I don't mean to sound cheap, but it would cost me a fortune. You really think it's warranted?"
"Let's put it this way. I wouldn't chance it if I were you. He's got 6 violent priors.
Oh.
Oh, indeed. The insulting part is he isn't even paying that much. 5 grand for the 4 of us. That's less than 1,500 bucks apiece.
He laughed when he said this, but I didn't think he was amused. I can't believe this, I said, still trying to take it in. When you're presented with bad news, there's always this lag time. The brain simply unable to assimilate the facts. Galashov was saying,
I do know a guy, if you decide that's what you want. He's a local PI with a background in security. At the moment he's burned out, but I know he's excellent.
Just what I need, somebody bored with his work. He laughed again.
Don't let that dissuade you. This guy's good. He lived in California years ago and loves it out there. He might like the change of scene.
I take it he's available.
As far as I know. I just talked to him a couple days ago. His name is Robert Dietz.
I felt a little jolt. Dietz? I know him. I talked to him about a year ago when I was working on a case.
You have his number?
It's around here someplace, but you might as well give it to me again, I said. He gave me the number, and I made a note. I'd only dealt with a man by phone, but he'd been thorough and efficient, and he hadn't charged me a cent. Really, I owed him one. I heard a buzz on Galashoff's end of the phone. He said,
Hang on a sec.
He clicked off, was gone briefly, and then clicked on again.
Sorry to cut it short, but I got a call coming in. Let me know what you decide.
I'll do that, I said. And thanks. Keep safe.
You too,
he said, and he was gone. I set the receiver down, still staring at the phone. A murder contract? How many times had someone tried to kill me in the last year? Well, not that many, I thought defensively, but this was something new. Nobody that I knew of had ever put out a contract on me. I tried to picture Tyrone Patty chatting up the subject with a hitman in Carson City. Somehow it seemed strange. For one thing, it was hard to imagine the kind of person who made a living that way. Was the work seasonal? Were there any fringe benefits? Was the price discounted since there were 4 of us to whack? I had to agree with Galashoff. 1,500 bucks was bullshit. In the movies, hitmen are paid 50 to 100 thou, possibly because an audience wants to believe human life is worth that. I suppose I should have been flattered I was included in the deal. A public defender, a DA, and a judge? Distinguished company for a small-town private eye like me. I stared at Dietz's number, but I couldn't bring myself to call. Maybe the crisis would pass before I had to take any steps to protect myself. The real question was, would I mention this to Henry Pitts? Nah, it would just upset him, and what was the point? When the knock at the door came, I jumped like I'd been shot. I didn't exactly flatten myself against the wall, but I exercised a bit of caution when I peered out to see who was there. It was Rosie, who owns the tavern in my neighborhood. She's Hungarian, with a last name I don't pronounce and couldn't spell on a dare. I suppose she's a mother substitute, but only if you favor being browbeaten by a member of your own sex. She was wearing one of her muumuus, this one olive green, printed with islands, palm trees, and parrots in hot pink and chartreuse. She was holding a plate, covered with a paper napkin. When I opened the door, she pushed it toward me without preamble, which has always been her style. Some people call it rude.
"I brought you some strudel for your birthday," she said. "Not apple, it's nut, the best I ever made. You gonna wish you had more."
"Well, Rosie, how nice!" I lifted a corner of the napkin. The strudel had a nibbled look, but she hadn't snitched very much. "It looks wonderful," I said.
"It was Clotilde's idea," she said in a fit of candor.
Rosie's in her 60s, short, top-heavy, her hair dyed the utterly faux orange-red of new bricks. I'm not certain what product she uses to achieve the effect. Probably something she smuggles in from Budapest on her biannual trips home. But it usually renders her scalp a fiery pink along the part. She had pulled the sides back today and affixed them with barrettes, a style much favored in the 5-year-old set. I'd spent the last 2 weeks helping her find a board and care facility for her sister Clotilde, who'd recently moved to Santa Teresa from Pittsburgh, where the winters were getting to be too much for her. Rosie doesn't drive, and since my apartment is just down the street from her little restaurant, it seemed expedient for me to help her find a place for Clotilda to live. Like Rosie, Clotilda was short and heavy-set, with an addiction to the same hair dye that tinted Rosie's scalp pink, and turned her tresses such a peculiar shade of red. Clotilda was in a wheelchair, suffering from a degenerative disease that left her cranky and impatient, though Rosie swore she'd always been that way. Theirs was a bickering relationship, and after an afternoon in their presence, I was cranky and impatient myself. After checking out 15 or 16 possibilities, we'd finally found a place that seemed to suit. Clotilda had been settled into a ground-floor room in a former two-family dwelling on the east side of town, so I was now off the hook. "You want to come in?" I held the door open while Rosie considered the invitation. She seemed rooted to the spot, rocking slightly on her feet. She becomes coquettish at times, usually when she's suddenly unsure of herself. On her own turf, she's as aggressive as a Canada goose.
"You might not want the company," she said, demurely lowering her eyes.
"Oh, come on," I said. "I'd love the company. You have to see the place. Henry did a great job." She wiggled once and then sidestepped her way into the living room. She seemed to survey the room out of the corner of her eye.
"Oh, very nice."
"I love it. You should see the loft," I said. I set the strudel on the counter and quickly put some water on for tea. I took her through the place, up the spiral steps and down, showing her the trundle bed, the cubby holes, the pegs for hanging clothes. She made all the proper noises, only chiding me mildly for the meagerness of my wardrobe. She claims I'll never get a beau unless I have more than one dress. After the tour, we had tea and strudel, working our way through every crispy bite. I cleaned the plate of flaky crumbs with a dampened fingertip. Her discomfort seemed to fall away, though mine increased as the visit went on. I'd known the woman for 2 years, but with the exception of the last couple of weeks, our entire relationship had been conducted in her restaurant, which she rules like a dominatrix. We didn't have that much to talk about, and I found myself manufacturing chit-chat, trying to ward off any awkward pauses in the conversation. By the time we finished tea, I was sneaking peeks at my watch. Rosie fixed me with a look.
"What's the matter? You got a date?"
"Well, no. I've got a job. I have to drive down to the desert tomorrow, and I need to get to the bank." She pointed a finger and then poked me on the arm.
"Tonight, you come to my place. I'm gonna buy you a glass of schnapps."
We left at the same time. I offered to drop her off, but the tavern's only half a block away, and she said she preferred to walk. The last I saw of her, the mild spring breezes were billowing through her muumuu. She looked like a hot air balloon shortly before liftoff. I headed into town, detouring by way of the automated teller machine at my bank, where I deposited Mrs. Gersh's advance and pulled $100 in cash. I circled the block and parked my car in the public lot behind my office. I confess this news about a hitman had made me conscious of my backside, and I suppressed the urge to zigzag as I went up the outside stairs. In my office, I picked up my portable typewriter, some files, and my gun, then stopped into the California Fidelity Insurance offices next door. I chatted briefly with Darcy Pascoe, who doubles as the company's secretary and receptionist. She had helped me on a couple of cases and was thinking about changing fields. I thought she'd be a good investigator, and I was encouraging her. Being a PI beats sitting on your ass at somebody else's front desk. I moved on to Vera Lipton's cubicle, completing my rounds. Vera's one of those women men are mad about. I swear it's not anything in particular she does. I suppose it's the air of total confidence she exudes. She likes men, and they know it, even when she sasses them. She's 37, single, addicted to cigarettes and Coca-Cola, which she consumes throughout the day. You'd think that would offend the health nuts, but it doesn't seem to cause dismay. She's tall, probably 140 pounds, a redhead who wears glasses with big round lenses tinted gray. I know none of this sounds like the girl of your dreams, but there's something about her that's apparently tough to resist. She's not in any way promiscuous, But if she goes to the supermarket, some guy will strike up a conversation with her and end up dating her for months. When the relationship's over, they usually remain such good friends that she'll match him up with someone she knows. She was not at her desk. I can usually track her by the smell of cigarette smoke, but today I was having trouble picking up the scent. I cleared a chair and sat down, taking a few minutes to flip through a handbook on insurance fraud. Wherever there's money, somebody finds a way to cheat.
Hello, Kinsey. What are you up to?
Vera came into the cubicle and tossed a file onto her desk. She was dressed in a denim jumpsuit with shoulder pads and a wide leather belt. She sat down in her swivel chair, reaching automatically into her bottom drawer where she keeps an insulated cold pack filled with Cokes. She took out a fresh bottle and held it up as a way of offering me one. I shook my head. She said,
"Guess what?"
"I'm afraid to ask."
"Take a look around and tell me what you see."
I love this kind of quiz. It reminds me of that game we used to play at birthday parties in elementary school, where somebody's mom would present a tray of odds and ends, which we got to look at for 1 minute and then recite back from memory. It's the only kind of party game I ever won. I surveyed her desk. Same old mess as far as I could see. Files everywhere, insurance manuals, correspondence piled up, 2 empty Coke bottles. "No cigarette butts," I said. "Where's the ashtray?"
"I quit."
"I don't believe it. When?"
"Yesterday. I woke up feeling punk, coughing my lungs out. I was out of cigarettes, so there I am on my hands and knees, picking through the trash for a butt big enough to light. Of course I can't find one. I know I'm going to have to throw some clothes on, grab my car keys, and whip down to the corner before I can even have my first Coke. And I thought, to hell with it. I've had it. I'm not going to do this to myself anymore. So I quit. That was 31 hours ago."
"Vera, that's great. I'm really proud of you."
"Thanks. It feels good. I keep wishing I could have a cigarette to celebrate. Stick around. You can watch me hyperventilate every 7 minutes when the urge comes up. What are you up to?"
"I'm on my way home," I said. "I just stopped by to say hi. I'll be gone tomorrow, and we'd talked about having lunch."
"Shoot, too bad. I was looking forward to it. I was going to fix you up."
"Fix me up? Like a blind date?" This news was about as thrilling to me as the notion of periodontal work.
"Don't use that tone, kiddo. This guy's perfect for you."
"I'm afraid to ask you what that means," I said.
"It means he isn't married, like someone I could name."
Her reference was to Jonah Robb, whose on-again, off-again marriage had been a source of conflict. I'd been involved with him intermittently since the previous fall, but the high had long since worn off.
"There's nothing wrong with that relationship," I said.
"Of course there is," she snapped.
"He's never there when you need him. He's always off with what's-her-face at some counseling session."
"Well, that's true enough." Jonah and Camilla seemed to move from therapist to therapist, switching every time they got close to a resolution of any kind. Conflict habituated, I think it's called. They'd been together since 7th grade and were apparently addicted to the dark side of love.
"He's never going to leave her," Vera said.
"That's probably true, but who gives a shit?"
"You do, and you know it."
"No, I don't," I said. "I'll tell you the truth. I really don't have room in my life for much more than I've got. I don't want a big, hot love affair. Jonah's a good friend, and he comes through for me often enough."
"Boy, are you out of touch."
"I don't want your rejects, Vera. That's the point."
"This is not a reject. It's more like a referral."
"You want to make a sales pitch?" "I can tell you want to make a sales pitch. Go ahead, fill me in. I can hardly wait."
"He's perfect."
"Perfect. Got it," I said, pretending to take notes. "Very nice. What else?"
"Except for one thing."
"Ah."
"I'm being honest about this," she replied righteously. "If he was totally perfect, I'd keep him for myself."
"What's the catch?"
"Don't rush me. I'll get to that. Just let me tell you his good points first."
I glanced at my watch.
"You have 30 seconds. He's smart, he's funny, he's caring, he's competent."
"What's he do for a living?"
"He's a doctor, a family practitioner, but he's not a workaholic.
He's really available emotionally. Honest, he's a sweet guy, but he doesn't take any guff.
Keep talking.
He's 39, never married, but definitely interested in commitment. He's physically fit, doesn't smoke or do drugs, but he's not obnoxious about it, you know what I mean? He isn't holier than thou.
Uh-huh,
I said in a monotone. I made a rolling motion with my hand, meaning get to the point.
He's good-looking, too. I'm serious, like an 8.5 on a scale of 1 to 10.
He skis, plays tennis, lifts weights.
He can't get it up, I said.
He's terrific in bed. I started laughing.
What's the deal, Vera? Is he a mouth breather? Does he tell jokes? You know I hate guys who tell jokes.
She shook her head.
He's short.
How short?
Maybe 5'4" and I'm 5'9".
I stared at her with disbelief.
So what? You've dated half a dozen guys who were shorter than you.
Yeah, well, secretly it always bothered me.
I stared at her some more.
You're going to reject this guy because of that?
Her tone became defiant.
Listen, he's terrific. He's just not right for me. I'm not making a judgment about him. This is just a quirk of mine.
What's his name?
Neil Hess.
I reached down and pulled a scrap of paper from her wastebasket. I took a pen from her desk.
Give me his number.
She blinked at me.
You'll really call him?
Hey, I'm only 5'6". What's a couple of inches between friends?
She gave me his number, and I dutifully made a note, which I tucked in my handbag.
I'll be out of town for a day, but I'll call him when I get back.
Well, great.
I got up to leave her office and paused at the door.
If I marry this guy, you have to be the flower girl.
Chapter 3. I bypassed my run the next morning, anxious to hit the road. I left Santa Teresa at 6 o'clock a.m., my car loaded with a duffel, my portable Smith Corona, the information about Irene Gersh's mother, my briefcase, miscellaneous junk, and a cooler in which I'd tucked a six-pack of Diet Pepsi, a tuna sandwich, a couple of tangerines, and a Ziploc bag of Henry's chocolate chip cookies. I took Highway 101 south, following the coastline past Ventura, where the road begins to cut inland. My little VW whined and strained, climbing the Camarillo grade until it reached the crest, coasting down into Thousand Oaks. By the time I reached the San Fernando Valley, it was nearly 7, and rush-hour traffic had crammed the road solidly from side to side. Vehicles were changing lanes with a speed and grace that I think of as street surfing, complete with occasional wipeouts. Smog veiled the basin, blocking out the surrounding mountains so completely that unless you knew they were there, you might imagine the land to be flat as a plate. At North Hollywood, the 134 splits off, heading toward Pasadena, while the 101 cuts south toward downtown L.A. On a map of the area, the heart of Los Angeles looks like a small hole in the center of a loosely crocheted pink shawl that spreads across Los Angeles County, trailing into Orange County to the south. Converging freeways form a tangle with high-rise buildings caught in the knot. I've never known anyone who actually had business in downtown Los Angeles. Unless you have a yen to see Union Station, Olvera Street, or Skid Row, the only reason to venture into the neighborhood around 6th and Spring is to check out the wholesale Gold Mart for jewelry, or the Cooper Building for name-brand clothing discounted to bargain basement prices. For the most part, you're better off speeding right on by. You'll notice that I'm skipping right over the events of Thursday night. I will say that I did indeed stop by Rosie's for the drink she'd promised, only to discover that she and Henry had arranged a surprise birthday party for me. It was one of those mortifying moments where the lights come up and everybody jumps out from behind the furniture. I couldn't believe it was happening. Jonah was there, and Vera, the rat, who hadn't breathed a word of it when I'd seen her earlier, Darcy and Mac from CFI, Moza from down the block, some of the regular bar patrons, and a former client or two. I don't know why it seems so embarrassing to admit, but they had a cake and actual presents that I had to open on the spot. I don't like to be surprised. I don't like to be the center of attention. These were all people I care about, but I found it unnerving to be the object of so much goodwill.
I suppose I said all the right things. I didn't get drunk, and I didn't disgrace myself. But I felt disconnected, like I was having an out-of-body experience. Reflecting on it now in the privacy of my car, I could feel myself smiling. Events like this always seem better to me in retrospect. The party had broken up at 10. Henry and Jonah walked me home, and after Henry excused himself, I showed Jonah the apartment, feeling shy as a bride. I got the distinct impression he wanted to spend the night, but I couldn't handle it. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was my earlier conversation with Vera. But I felt distant, and when he moved to kiss me, I found myself easing away.
What's the matter?
Nothing. It's just time for me to be alone.
Did I do something to piss you off?
Hey, no, I promise. I'm exhausted, that's all. The party tonight just about did me in. You know me. I don't do well in situations like that. He smiled, his teeth flashing white.
You should have seen the look on your face. It was great. I think it's funny to see you caught off guard.
He was leaning against the door with his hands behind his back, the light from the kitchen painting one side of his face with a warm yellow glow. I found myself taking a mental picture of him. Blue eyes, dark hair. He looked tired. Jonah is a Santa Teresa cop who works the missing persons detail, which is how we'd met almost a year ago. I really wasn't sure what I felt for him at this point. He's kind, confused, a good man who wants to do the right thing, whatever that is. I understood his dilemma with his wife, and I didn't blame him for his part in it. Of course he was going to vacillate. He has two young daughters who complicate the matter no end. Camilla had left him twice, taking the girls with her both times. He'd managed to do all right without her, but the first time she crooked her little finger, he'd gone running back. It had been push-pull since then, double messages. In November, she decided they should have an open marriage, which he figured was a euphemism for her screwing around on him. He felt that freedom up to get involved with me, but I was reasonably certain he'd never mentioned it to her. How open could this open marriage be? While I didn't want much from the relationship, I found it disquieting that I never knew where I stood. Sometimes he behaved like a family man, taking his girls to the zoo on Sunday afternoons. Sometimes he acted like a bachelor father, doing exactly the same thing. He and his daughters spent a lot of time staring at the monkeys while Camilla did God knows what. For my part, I felt like a peripheral character in a play I wouldn't have paid to see. I didn't need the aggravation, to tell you the truth. Still, it's hard to complain when I'd known his marital status from the outset. Hey, no sweat, I'd thought. I'm a big girl. I can handle it. Clearly, I hadn't the slightest idea what I was getting into.
What's that expression? He said to me.
I smiled. That's good night. I'm bushed.
I'll get out of here then and let you get some sleep. You've got a great place. I'll expect a dinner invitation when you get back.
Yeah, you know how much I love to cook.
We'll send out.
Good plan.
You call me.
I'll do that. Truly, the best moment of the day came when I was finally by myself. I locked the front door and then circled the perimeter, making sure the windows were securely latched. I turned out the lights downstairs and climbed my spiral staircase to the loft above. To celebrate my first night in the apartment, I ran a bath, dumping in some of the bubble bath Darcy had given me for my birthday. It smelled like pine trees and reminded me of janitorial products employed by my grade school. At the age of 8, I'd often wondered what maintenance wizard came up with the notion of throwing sawdust on barf. I turned the bathroom light off and sat in the steaming tub, looking out the window toward the ocean, which was visible only as a band of black with a wide swath of silver where the moon cut through the dark. The trunks of the sycamores just outside the window were a chalky white, the leaves pale gray, rustling together like paper in the chill spring breeze. It was hard to believe there was somebody out there hired to kill me. I'm well aware that immortality is simply an illusion we carry with us to keep ourselves functional from day to day, but the idea of a murder contract was inconceivable to me. The bath water cooled to lukewarm, and I let it galumph away,
the sound reminding me of every bath I'd ever taken. At midnight, I slid naked between the brand-new sheets on my brand-new bed, staring up through the skylight. Stars lay on the plexiglass dome like grains of salt, forming patterns the Greeks had named centuries ago. I could identify the Big Dipper, even the Little Dipper sometimes, but I'd never seen anything that looked even remotely like a bear, a belt, or a scuttling crab. Maybe those guys smoked dope back then, lying on their backs near the Parthenon, pointing at the stars and bullshitting the night away. I wasn't even aware that I had fallen asleep until the alarm jolted me back to reality again. I focused on the road, glancing down occasionally at the map spread open on the passenger seat. Joshua Tree National Monument and Anza Borrego Desert State Park were blocked out in dark green, shaped like the pieces of a giant jigsaw puzzle. The national forests were tinted a paler green, while the Mojave itself was a pale beige, mountain ranges shaded in the palest brush strokes. Much of the desert would never be civilized, and that was cheering somehow. While I'm not a big fan of nature, its intractability amuses me no end. At the San Bernardino Riverside exit, the arms of the freeway crisscross, sweeping upward like some vision of the future in a 1950s textbook. Beyond, there is nothing on either side of the road but telephone lines, canyons the color of brown sugar, fences of wire with tumbleweeds blown against them. In the distance, a haze of yellow suggested that the mesquite was in bloom again. Near Cabazon, I pulled into a rest stop to stretch my legs. There were 8 or 10 picnic tables in a grassy area shaded by willows and cottonwoods. Restrooms were housed in a cinder block structure with an A-line roof. I availed myself of one, air-drying my hands since the paper towels had run out. It was now 10 o'clock, and I was hungry, so I pulled out my cooler and set it up on a table some 10 yards from the parking lot. The virtue of being single is you get to make up all the rules. Dinner at midnight? Why not? It's just you. Lunch at 10 a.m.? Sure, you're the boss. You can eat when you want and call it anything you like. I sat facing the road, munching on a sandwich while I watched cars come and go. A kid, maybe 5, was playing with an assortment of matchbox trucks on the walkway while his father napped on a bench. Pop had a copy of Sports Illustrated open across his face, his big arms bared in a T-shirt with the sleeves torn out. The air was mild and warm, the sky an endless wash of blue. On the road again, I passed the wind farms where electricity is generated in acre after acre of turbines arranged in rows like whirligigs. Today, gusts were light. I could watch the breezes zigzag erratically through the turbines, visible in the whimsical twirling of slender blades, like the propellers on lighter-than-aircraft. Maybe, when man is gone, these odd totems will remain, merrily harvesting the elements, converting wind into power to drive ancient machines. Approaching Palm Springs, the character of the road begins to change again. Billboards advertise fast-food restaurants and gasoline. RV country clubs are heralded as residential communities for active adults. Behind the low hills, mountains loom, barren except for the boulders bleached by the sun. I passed a trailer park called Vista Del Mar Estates, but there was no Mar in view. I took Highway 111 south, passing through the towns of Coachella, Thermal, and Mecca. The Salton Sea came into view on my right. For long stretches, there were only the 2 lanes of asphalt, powdery dirt on either side, the body of water shimmering gray in the rising desert heat. At intervals, I would pass a citrus grove, an oasis of shade in a valley otherwise drubbed by unrelenting sun. I drove through Calipatria. Later, I heard area residents refer to a town I thought was called Cowpat, which I realized belatedly was a shortened version of Calipatria. The only landmark of note there is a building downtown with one brick column that looks like it's been chewed on by rats. It's actually earthquake damage left unrepaired, perhaps in an effort to pacify the gods. 15 miles south of Calipatria is Brawley. On the outskirts of town, I spotted a motel with a vacancy sign. The Vagabond was a two-story L-shaped structure of perhaps 40 rooms, bracketing an asphalt parking lot. I rented a single and was directed to room 20 at the far end of the walk. I eased my car into the space out in front, where I unloaded the duffel, the typewriter, and the cooler. The room was serviceable, though it smelled faintly of eau de bug. The carpet was a two-toned green nylon and a shag long enough to mow. The bedspread and matching drapes were a green and gold floral print, flowering vines of some kind climbing up parallel trellises. The painting above the double bed showed a moose standing in lake water up to his knees. The painted mountains were the same shade of green as the rug. Just a little decorating hint from those of us in the know. I put a call through to Henry to tell him where I was. Then I dumped my belongings, christened the toilet bowl, and took off again, tracking north as far as the little hamlet of Nyland. I pulled into what would have passed for a curb, had there been a sidewalk in view. I asked a leather-faced rancher in a pair of overalls for directions to the slabs. He pointed without a word. I took a right turn at the next corner and drove another mile and a half through flat countryside, interrupted only by telephone poles and power lines. Occasionally, I crossed an irrigation canal, where brown grasses hugged the banks. In the distance to the right, I caught sight of a hillock of raw dirt, crowned by an outcropping of rock painted with religious sentiments. God is love, and repent loomed large. Whatever was written under it, I couldn't read. Probably a Bible quote. There was a dilapidated truck parked nearby, with a wooden house built on the back, also painted with exhortations of some fundamentalist sort. I passed what must have served as a guard post when the original military base was still functioning. All that remained was a 3-by-3-foot concrete shell, only slightly bigger than a telephone booth. I drove on to the old base. A few hundred yards down the road, a second guardhouse had been painted sky blue. Evergreens were outlined on the face of it, with "Welcome to" painted in black letters on the roofline, and "Slab City" in an arch of black letters on white, with white doves flying in all directions. "God is love" was lettered in two places, the paint job apparently left over from the 60s when the hippies came through. Nothing in the desert perishes, except the wildlife, of course. The air is so dry that nothing seems to rot, and the heat, while intense through much of the year, preserves more than it destroys. I'd passed abandoned wood cabins that had probably been sitting empty for 60 years. Here in the endless stretch of gravel and dirt, I could see numerous vans, a few automobiles, many with doors hanging open to dispel the heat. Trailers, RVs, tents, and pickup trucks with camper shells were set up in makeshift neighborhoods. The wide avenues were defined by clumps of creosote and mesquite. Only one roadway was marked, and the sign, propped up against a stone, read 18th Street. Along the main road, one of the world's longest flea markets had been laid out. The tables were covered with odds and ends of glass, used clothing, old tires, used car seats, defunct television sets, which were being sold cheap, C-H-E-E-P.